Argue, talk, exaggerate, pontificate, just shut up. Why won't you listen? Why won't you see? I know the story, just listen to me.
You're better off when you're spouting off. And now, here's your host, Karen Cataline.
And welcome. This is Karen Cataline, and you're listening to Spouting Off. What a pleasure to be with you this April 3rd, 2018. And we are still celebrating Holy Week. I mean, it's over now, but just barely. And we had Easter, Good Friday, Passover, the first 2 days of Passover, all just this past weekend. And so I have some stuff planned that has to do with that because we are still, you know, experiencing that. But I was thinking, you know, excuse me, in a world where teens are snorting condoms, eating Tide Pods, hiding in box stores overnight as a way to challenge themselves, while other teens are lecturing the rest of us on gun control and what it is to have a democracy, and it's not, by the way, it's a republic, there's only one thing we can do, and that's to talk about the Bible. And that is what we're going to do this week, and I not only am going to take the first half of the program to talk to you about a new book that's out that I'm so jazzed about that I wanted to talk about it here on Spouting Off, because everything is grist for our mill, including the Bible, which is the seminal book on which so much else of Western civilization is based. And in our second half hour, I have a friend and a wonderful man who is not only an author in his own right, but a pastor. His name is Pastor Stephen Grant, and he is involved in so much. Among those things is a movement to get studying the Bible in public schools. Now, you may say, well, how is that possible in this virulently secular world in which people are trying to destroy biblical ideas right and left? There are no biblical ideas on the left too much. But that being said, how are you possibly going to get people to study the Bible in public schools? Well, for one thing, you offer it as an elective. It's not forced. For the second thing, you offer it as literature and art on which so much else, as I said before, is based. And it's difficult to understand much else of Western civilization if you do not understand the Bible. If you X that out of your frame of reference, you're doing yourself a terrible disservice. And we as Jews love to struggle and wrestle with everything. So to just simply close your eyes is a silly thing to do. But on that score, we have somebody, something to talk about to set all this up for us. And before I do that, if you'd like to join us, I have some to talk to you about, but you are always welcome to join in the conversation. It may take me a little bit to get to your phone call, but just so you know, if you are so inclined, you can call 888-627-6008 or 323-744-4831. So this week on April 1st, and it happened to have been Easter Sunday and the third day of Passover. We are now in the fifth day of Passover, April 3rd. Do I have that right? Yes, I think I do. A very long awaited book came out, which I thought was absolutely perfect to discuss. And that is Dennis Prager's new book called The Rational Bible. Well, the minute I heard about this, now I, like a good many modern Jews, have had a very, very up and down, circuitous kind of relationship with my own religion. And I question everything. And it took a little while for me to realize and to accept that that is as Jewish as you can get. And that is to question everything. So this book, The Rational Bible, and I really love the subtitle because it's clear this is going to be probably a 5-book series. Maybe he'll do the whole Tanakh. But he decided, Dennis Prager, that he would begin with the book of Exodus, which, as you know, as some know, not all of us know, Exodus is the second book in the 5 books of Moses. His subtitle is God, Slavery, and Freedom. What an apt title to the book. And so about 3-4 days before the book came out, I decided to get it on Kindle, and it ended up in my Kindle, on my Kindle book, just on Sunday at the end of the day. And I just started reading, and the more I read, the more excited I became. Because I have, for the longest time, and I love exploring new ideas of all sorts. I mean, that's obviously why politics has mattered to me as much as it has. I was excited because in my own studies, and it's a very Jewish thing also, and I've got to tell you, that's my frame of reference, so that's where I'm going to come from. I like to call myself putting the Judeo in Judeo-Christian, and indeed that is what I try to do, at least in my own way. Anyway, when I have sought out teachers in my life, in Judaism, because it's just a very, very big thing to say, I'm learning with so-and-so, I'm learning with someone else. Teachers are everywhere. And in Judaism, because we don't elevate any man to the level of God, which I enjoy very much about my religion, I just really enjoy that particular concept. I think it is important. So people learn together. And of course, you can learn from everyone. You can learn from rabbis, but we don't look at rabbis as having the end-all, be-all answer to everything. In fact, our two greatest Torah commentators, and by the way, just in case you don't know, we call the Torah the 5 books of Moses, and the Tanakh the 5 books of Moses, and the Proverbs and all the rest that Christians call the Old Testament. But when we study Torah, I know what I was going to say. I'm sorry, got off the track there. Our two of our greatest sages, and there have been many because it's an old religion, we have Rashi and we have the Rambam, and both of them often disagree because it's up to them, or in those days, and some of those many of those commentaries are in modern versions of even the most orthodox of books. In fact, there's books and books of just commentary. And that's important because we continue to find the Torah valuable in our daily lives. But here was my question when I sought out teachers. And that was, it's very difficult for modern Jews of today who didn't live a Torah life, who didn't live a Torah lifestyle, didn't grow up observant in Judaism, although ethnically they're very Jewish, you know, they eat chicken soup and matzah balls at Passover. But many of us, a good deal of the heart and the soul of the religion really got watered down with chicken soup when Jews came to this country, because, and this is a generalization, I always try to just point that out. When Jews came to this country, they wanted so desperately to assimilate, to be Americans. They loved America. They wanted America. They wanted the religious freedom and the religious pluralism of America. They didn't come to America to convert anybody, but just to be free to practice their religion as they saw fit. So how ironic it is that they came to America for the freedom to practice this, our religion, and also, you know, to live their dreams, to live the American dream. And then what happens, a good deal of our religion got watered down. So, excuse me. You know, it's the crud of the morning, afternoon. So that is what I want to talk about. Let's get to this book, which excited the heck out of me because there wasn't a bridge. That's what I meant to say. There isn't a bridge for people who really didn't study Torah to make it as relevant as possible to modern life. You go to very, very Orthodox places and they're studying Torah, no doubt about that. They're talking about God. But when you go into a synagogue, there's not always this sense of relevance to what's happening in modern day life. And the challenges of modern day life, just as I mentioned before, where we have high school kids not only lecturing us on the Second Amendment, but eating Tide Pods and staying overnight in box stores because that's challenging to them. That doesn't mean all teenagers are that way, but there is an enormous amount of head scratching stuff that'll make your head explode. So much, well, you can call it irony, but in many ways it's just profound contradiction. And so, you know, what is a modern person to do? I was just excited as all get out when I saw this book. Dennis Prager, as you may or may not know, is a syndicated talk show host, a great teacher who has been a talk show host for decades. And when I lived in New York, he did a show called Religion on the Line. I didn't know who Dennis Prager was. But I, you know, I had a love-hate relationship with my religion, as many Jews do. So I didn't listen too often, but when I did listen, I was always found it compelling. And he had every kind of person as his guest. On one, I think it's Saturday morning that it was on live, he had pastors and preachers and imams and atheists and rabbis and everything. And they talked about the great questions of life. And I found that to be wonderful. Later, I had an opportunity to sit in Dennis Prager's studio when he did one of his radio shows. And I even, he didn't exactly remember me. In fact, I know he didn't because he has fans everywhere. He is really prominent and has done a wonderful job, by the way, of bridging the gap between Christians and Jews as well, because Christians look to him as a modern day teacher of Torah and what they call the Old Testament. We don't call it the Old Testament because it's our book. I watched him conduct a Sabbath service in California. So he is eminently qualified and enormously eloquent, and he has passion for the subject, and he is not afraid to ask the tough questions. Why should we believe in God? Is the Bible man-written, or has it been divinely? Has it been written or by God or inspired by God? Is it divine in any way? And that really is the Jewish way, which is to ask questions in order to learn. It's the way I always have. And when I'm listening, I like to have that back and forth. One other thing, that in our religion, in Judaism, is just in our tradition, we aren't penalized for daring to ask questions. We are held accountable for our actions, no question about it. But to question and even to doubt is not a mortal sin, that being a Catholic reference, but it's not a mortal sin in Judaism, because if you care enough to question, that means you care, right? And as many people know, the opposite of hatred the opposite of love is apathy. And if you're so apathetic as not to question, then, you know, what does it matter? That's my commentary. But why did he decide to read this book and write this book? And what I love is that he directs his chapters. He directs at the beginning in the introduction some comments to various audiences, to Jewish readers, to Christian readers, and to secular readers and or atheists. And he thinks it's important for many ways. as I've begun to read this book on my Kindle, and I just bought it in a hard copy so I can share it. It's always so much more fun to have a hard copy of a book, to have it in your hot little hands where you can dog ear the picture, the corners, and share it and give it away. I mean, I hope we never lose that we have actual books. But for a book this important, I thought it was important to own it. And I encourage you to get it as well and argue with it if you choose to. What's great about it, not only are there wonderful essays by Dennis Prager on some of the biggest issues, but he really tackles some of the various verses in the Bible. Things like, here's a reason in Dennis's mind, and many others, I've heard this before, that man didn't write the Bible. And or Jews didn't write the Bible themselves, man, excuse me, because it depicts Jews in such a negative light. It's a bit circular logic, but I'm going to move faster because I don't have much time. I want to bring on Stephen Grant soon, and I wanted to get through this here. And he also says that all things in life are choices, and to believe in God is a choice. Choose to believe, or else man is his own God. Now, I loved this because I have been and have been a very stubborn, you know, have to question everything. And it was politics that really led me to appreciate that I surely didn't want to believe that God, that man is God. To me, that was a line over which I didn't want to cross, for sure. I once went in many of my travels and explorations to it wasn't a universalist church, it was a humanist church. Humanists are basically atheists. And there was a humanist synagogue that had the Shema prayer, the most important cornerstone prayer in Judaism, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. That is the cornerstone of the Jewish religion. And they took God out of the Shema prayer. Huh? I mean, I had a lot of questions, but to take God out of the Shema prayer, why bother? You know? So I went up to the leader and I said to him, I really, really want to thank you. And he was so happy. He thought he had a new convert, I guess. And I said, because you gave me a line over which, finally, I am unwilling to cross, that God is in charge. I mean, excuse me, that man is in charge. There's another concept that I really love and one that I've only come to later on. And Dennis mentions this a lot. Before I get to it, I want to say I'm very much at the beginning of this book, and I think he's going to have more. And I'm going to go after those with the same zeal that I'm enjoying this one. I really have only begun to read it, and I think it's important. I want to revisit this when I've read it more, because I think this exploration of God and the Bible and what it means to you, what's its significance to you? It's a very personal thing. In fact, I wasn't even sure I was going to talk about this, but I thought, you know, this is what I'm jazzed about right now. So this show is about what I'm jazzed about. And how exciting for him to write a book about this. And he talks at length, and I encourage you to buy the book and read it, about why he thinks it's so important to write it now, to put it out now. And I think we'll be talking about that with Stephen Grant as well. So I didn't forget what I teased you about, and that is Dennis Prager talks at some length about the term fear of God. And that term has been around for a long time. But in this modern culture that we have, people assume that the idea of a fear of God is a terrible thing. And if we want to market God better, we have to make him less feared and more loved, right? Well, little did I know, I had a teacher once tell me that the people that gave the idea of God loves you, you know, smile, God loves you, That was one of the cornerstones also of the Jewish religion. God loves you, you know, or he wouldn't have created you in his image and unique to you. But this was what was great. Today, people are thinking, well, you know, you gotta kind of downplay that that idea of fear of God, because, or someone put the fear of God in you, and oh, we can't have fear because today we like fast, easy, fun, cheap. That's the culture of today: fast, easy, fun, and cheap. And if it's something fearful and we're gonna have to struggle with it, well, gee, do we really, really want that? Well, I came to an understanding of this idea, and I loved this idea. See, to me, this rebellious, stubborn person that I am, you can even call me stiff-necked. That's all right. Not stick-necked, but sniff-necked. I thought the idea of fear of God is a wonderful idea. Because during the years of the last administration, I was really scared. I was scared for my country. I was scared for the future of freedom, because God forbid, there it is again, if freedom is lost, if freedom dies in America, it may not be alive anywhere in the world. And we would enter a very, very dark place. And I was deeply afraid of just the socialist marchings that started in the Obama years and are continuing to show themselves, but they're much more overt and much more obvious today than they were. It's not even a sin to be a socialist today or to advocate socialism. I mean, Bernie Sanders is an avowed socialist, but I digress. So I found, and many, many other people do, we have done a terrible job of helping people understand why socialism, communism, and all those isms are the path to tyranny, and very often, even in and most in the 20th century, the path to genocide, the path to very, very dark, dark times in the world. So the fear of God figured in prominently to my thinking, because I was so scared of what men were doing to other men, what men were doing to freedom. And when I finally, shall we say, grokked the concept of the fear of God as a good and healthy thing, guess what? If you fear God, which is a good thing, and you don't have to, you can do other things besides fear God, many, many, many other layers to a relationship, well, guess what? You fear man less. If I fear God, then I don't have to fear man as much. Because believe me, I don't want to live in a world where man is the highest authority. Man holds himself out to be God. That is one of the reasons it's so important that Jews are reflected in a negative light. Even Moses, and I'm not a great Bible scholar, I really want to do more and to study more and to learn more, but believe me, I'm the furthest thing in the world from a Bible scholar, but Moses wasn't perfect either. He hit the rock instead of tapped the rock, you know, all those things. And Jews are constantly being stubborn and stiff-necked and never learn, and they make a golden calf. And to be that negative is to show us today that if our great sages who came up with some of the greatest ideas that have civilized mankind, well, I just said men came up with them, but if men have kept to this Bible and have shared it from generation to generation, and they are sages who were, many of them, great men, if they could be fallible, they were men, not God, then we can too. And so it's a book, as Christians would say, the Old Testament, and I call the Torah, that gives you lots of examples of what not to do, because it knows you're human and they were too. And that's important, because those examples have been used to demonize Jews in our history. And that's really sad, makes me very sad. We are humans. We Jews are fallible too. And many times people get angry at Jews because they don't live up to the expectation. Jews themselves have always been very uncomfortable with the idea of being a chosen people. In fact, I've met evangelical Christians who are more comfortable with that term than most Jews that I know, including myself. But the idea of being chosen is not to be better than. It is merely to be chosen for a special purpose. You know that old thing, you know, what I have here are the laws of man. And the Jews said, how much are they? They said, well, they're free. And Jews said, we'll take 10. Now, that I don't like telling those jokes because sometimes people get the wrong idea. But Jews decided to follow the law, and God chose them to, as it would say in the Bible, to be a light unto the nations and to bring the law to man. Doesn't mean everybody has to be of the same mind. So I could go on and on, and I am going on and on. One more thing before we break about this wonderful book called The Rational Bible. I encourage you all to get it. It's on Amazon. You can get it on Kindle. You can get it in an audio book. It's great. And especially look at the introduction is where I'm at. I'm so excited. I'm still at the introduction. And then I'm zipping around. And he even says, you know, you can zip around in this book and read what calls to you to read. You can disagree, you can argue, but the book tells why it's so important today, because when civilization has ignored and gone away from the Bible, dark things have happened. Liberals would disagree and say that it's been people of religion that have started the wars, but I don't think so. Was Stalin a person of the Bible? I think not. The greatest mass murderer in the 20th century. So, the only verse inscribed on the Liberty Bell, as Dennis Prager reminds us, is from the Torah. Proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. And that's a biblical reference from the book of Leviticus 25:10. So that's what is proclaimed on the Liberty Bell. And as you may know, George Washington used the Jews, this Passover of being freed from slavery, as an inspiration for America coming into freedom and building a self-governing country. And that's what we need to preserve. I believe that my next guest, Stephen Grant, will have a whole lot to say about this and more. We have a great time when he comes on the line. So when I come back and when we come back from this break, we will meet Pastor Stephen Grant, and you're going to want to stay tuned. This is Spouting Off with Karen Cataline, and we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Eric, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arne, on natural rights versus entitlements.
America was founded on the idea that human beings are born with natural rights, such as the rights to life, liberty, and property. A person who holds this view of rights makes no demands on others except that they respect those rights. Today, however, many Americans talk about rights to a college education, state-of-the-art medical care, and even birth control pills. These are rights understood as entitlements, and a person who holds this view of rights, far from making no demands on other people, is making claims on other people's money and resources. This understanding of rights not only sets citizens against each other, but it undermines the whole idea of natural rights.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket Constitution and Declaration, go to constitutionminute.com.
Do you have a secret that's been bothering you? Have you been wondering if what you're thinking or feeling is normal? Is there someone with whom you've needed to clear the air, but you haven't been able to find the right words? Sometimes you need an objective, second opinion to help you see your problem more clearly. Ask Aunt Emma, and she'll help you move past what's getting in your way. She's a former therapist who is wise and caring, but instead of therapy, she'll give you terrific advice. It's free to ask Aunt Emma and explain your need, problem, or question. If you both agree, you pay only $1.39 a minute. It's anonymous, it's confidential, and you'll be surprised at how effective it is. You can ask Aunt Emma by going to facebook.com/askAuntEmma. There, you'll find her phone number and extension number. That's facebook.com/askAuntEmma. Ask Aunt Emma today.
Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. It's a community of like-minded people who work together to pay for their medical costs. You choose your doctor and hospital, starting at $107 a month for a single, up to $449 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all kids. For more info, visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org.
We're back. This is Spouting Off, and I'm your host, Karen Cataline. And as promised, we have with us Pastor Stephen Grant. What a wonderful and just multi-talented fellow Stephen Grant is. Not only am I proud to call him a friend, he's a musician, he's a pastor, he's an author. And welcome to Spouting Off, Stephen Grant.
Thank you, Karen. It's sure good to be with you.
It's good to be with you, too. Did you know that your real name is actually a fictional character, Pastor Stephen Grant, in some novel somewhere?
No. Is that right?
Yeah, when I Google it.
Is that right?
And it says, Pastor Stephen Grant, you are a character in a novel. And I'm here to tell everybody that you actually exist. So if people want to find you... And we were talking about this. If people want to find you, no, he is not a fictional character. He's the real Pastor Stephen Grant. And don't confuse him with the novels. A whole series.
No joke.
You should look that up.
I'm gonna have to get things figured out and figure out how to bump up my name recognition on Google or something. I don't know.
Well, either that or the novel is helping you. I mean, I guess you could always say, well, you never know if that's me.
True.
That's a lot of adventures I'm in, you know. Tell us a little bit about that.
That is fascinating. I did know at one point in time that there was a comic book writer named Stephen Grant, but that's a dubious honor.
Yeah, so. Yeah, not a comic book, but when I Googled, you know, Pastor Stephen Grant, it was this whole series of books by an author whose name escapes me. But let's jump right in because I don't want to waste any time with you. I mean, you and I could talk for 2-3 hours and have at times. So tell us.
And we have.
Yes, we have. And we're due. A little bit more about your background so people know who you are.
Well, I am a pastor, and I have pastored for 30-plus years, and as such, have also written American the Bible. We soon to have another manuscript coming out that my brother Stan Grant and I are joint authoring, and so that's about to break this summer. And also a musician, love music, love to play it, love to sing it, love to hear it. And, you know, my greatest joy is just returning America to what it needs to be, because today America is so messed up and so angry and so hate-filled, and it doesn't need to be this way. We can return it to life as it ought to be.
You gave me the perfect segue into this Bible project. Tell everybody about this Bible project and how you came to get into it and what are its main mission. What's its main mission?
Several years ago, I became acquainted with a couple of curricula that are available to the American public. There is one that you can find in BibleInSchools.net. It's the primary one that's being used. And basically, it is a high school elective curriculum that presents the Bible in American history, literature, and all of the different things that the Bible was used for. And, of course, here in the United States of America, since we were founded around Judaism and Christianity, you can't get away from Judaism or Christianity get away from education without using those two. It's just phenomenal how they intersect. And so I started introducing this, and it was fascinating what I ran into several years ago. So I've been at this a few years, and we're having some success. And actually, there's a movement going on around the nation right now that is just starting to swell out of the ground with people that want to reclaim a common fabric and a common thread to Americans' heritage and history.
That's wonderful. And I think I remember you telling me that there's some history to the oldest church and the oldest synagogue, and when was the oldest mosque and all of that, you know, because people think that we're just one giant melting pot and we have no basic founding. Well, that's just not true, is it?
No, it's absolutely not true. And I've had different people say, well, if we teach the Bible in school, then we're going to have to teach the Quran. Well, I have news for you. The Quran's already there. And there are people that are propagating it and pushing it right before our very eyes. But the fact of the matter is this, that Buddha wasn't on the boat and Muhammad wasn't on the Mayflower. All of these things came much, much, much later. So, for example, the first church in the American colonies was 1607 in Jamestown. And then the first permanent church was established, of course, in the Plymouth colony in 1620. And it's been in constant operation ever since then. We have the first mosque that was the Touro Mosque. It was the one that George Washington wrote and extended a hand of fraternal friendship and brotherhood to. And that was in Rhode Island. And that was around 1680. And so Judaism and Christianity have interacted literally for centuries here in the United States. Now, in the meantime, the first mosque in the United States of America was not built until 1929. The first Buddhist temple was 1850. The first Hindu temple was in Queens, New York in 1977. So the argument that we were just built on this polyglot of religion and our foundations were multicultural, multi-global essences and so forth doesn't hold water. We were built on the Bible. Most importantly, I think we were built on the Old Testament from the ground up and from the inside out.
Another reason to buy the Rational Bible. I should go to work for him as a marketer or something. So, you know, here's a question that a lot of people have continued to debate, and they probably will continue too long into the, you know, well into the future. And that was, were our founders deists? Were they theists? Were they, what were they, do you think? And of course, not everybody falls into a bucket. But like, for example, Thomas Jefferson, right? Are you a student of that particular study there?
I am. And it's very, very interesting because 27 of the more than 50 signers of the Declaration were actually theology students.
Uh-huh.
And so these were people that read, that understood the debated scriptures in Hebrew, Greek, Latin, other languages. John Jay, by the way, his entrance exam into King's College, he was the first Supreme Court Chief Justice. He had to defend his treatise on scriptures in Greek and articulate things in order to enter college, and came out with theology certification as well as with his law degree. And so these were the kinds and the caliber of men there was in that area. Yeah. Now, you'll hear a lot of people that will argue about Thomas Jefferson, and they'll also argue about Benjamin Franklin and say, well, they were just mere deists. Well, if you look at the five tenets of cultural deism back in that era of history, it would sound much like the tenets of Christianity today. Deism was not just this, well, there's a God out there that just let us go. They believed in an afterlife. They believed in God, that he ought to be feared and served. They believed in morality and godliness, that we ought to seek after God and find who he is. And so deism during that era was much more akin to today's Christianity. It's very fascinating.
Steve, do you think that the idea of deist, as opposed to, I don't even know what the contrary to that would be, has to do with the idea of a personal relationship with God rather than just a creator? Is that where the kind of invisible line is, or am I wrong?
Well, I think so. Today, what happens is today, deism is defined as being a God being identified through nature and reason instead of by revelation. So deism is something that is used by some as a stepping stone into atheism. Deism is also used by some people to say, well, I'm by nature agnostic. So those are some of the things about deistic thought today. It's like, well, I'm spiritual, but I'm not
religious.
I'm not religious. Yeah.
I've heard that before. Yeah.
There
was I've got to find this because I utterly love it, and I hope that I typed it out. Doggone it. I got to remember it from memory. And that was one of the phrases in Prager's book that I loved so much, was that you can be an agnostic intellectually, but you cannot live your life as an agnostic. You either live your life as one who believes in God, or you live your life as an atheist. You can't live your life as an agnostic. And so that gives you permission to be agnostic intellectually, but leaves open the room that there's just so much more besides the intellectual. There are all those things which we cannot see. And even the greatest atheist, or whatever that is, admits that there are things we cannot see that exist, like love, like, you know, that there's more to life than just the intellect. So, I just thought I'd throw that out because it seemed reasonable to mention.
Well, it sounds to me like Prager has been reading Greek again, because the word agnostic literally comes from the Greek word agnoio. Now, that has three separate definitions. Actually, many times in Scripture, the word agnostic is translated as ignorant. So when you look at the term agnostic, you can be agnostic because you just don't know what you don't know. In other words, you've not been taught something, so you're agnostic, you're ignorant about something. Second thing is you can be agnostic because you do not have the mental capacity to understand. So you don't know because you can't handle it. You just don't know. You don't have the brain power to handle that. Or the third area is, you're agnostic because you want to be, and you're willfully ignorant and don't want anybody to tell you anything. So many times when I meet with people and talk with people, and they say, well, I'm an agnostic, I'll say, great, that's awesome. I was once too. What kind are you? Because it'll tell you what they want.
Herein is a wonderful little unique difference, I think, between Christianity and Judaism. And you know what I always say, vive la difference, you know? I think it's great that there are theological differences between Christians and Jews. And as long as both are free to practice their religion as they see fit and are not being converted at the point of a gun, as some religions like to do, then I'm cool with it. Okay. But being an agnostic, I would submit that maybe there's a fourth one, which is not, I don't know. You know, a lot of people say, I don't know and I don't care. It's not that I don't know and I don't care. It's that I don't know and I care very much. And what Prager is saying there is that it's okay to have doubts. It's okay to question. It's okay to not be sure, but to choose to believe and to intellectually know that there are limits on that level of knowledge is a good thing. I don't know how articulate I was with that, but I mean, I don't think it's not as much of a sin in Judaism to be agnostic, because we're a faith, if you will, of acts rather than faith. So you could be the biggest doubter in the world, but if you, and it's not up to us to say who's going to be sitting in the front row in the afterlife. You know, we don't know where God will place us all, as has been said. So, but you are judged and you are held accountable for your actions, for what you chose to do, what you consciously chose to do. So I just thought I would throw that out as a difference.
And it is. I think one of the interesting things about agnosticism is the fact that, by its very definition, agnosticism seeks to understand. Taoism is a step back from that, because Taoism is the very fact that there is a way, but you cannot know the way. And so it leaves you constantly skeptical, constantly seeking, and yet not finding, and someday in an afterlife, you will be illuminated. Agnosticism says, I don't know how the car works, but I'm going to figure out a way. I know that it's supposed to work somehow, and I'm going to be a seeker in that.
That's very, very interesting. I think that is very common to a good many of Jewish, secular Jews today. They're very much caught up in, or, you know, we all are caught up in intellect, and we forget that there is the experience of God on another level, for one thing. And we are supposed to seek. It doesn't mean we'll always find, but we must continue to question and seek. And might as well throw this out too, and that's the definition, the name of Jacob, which is to wrestle with God. Well, if you didn't care, you wouldn't wrestle. You'd ignore.
Exactly.
But if you're always wrestling and questioning because you want to know, right.
And because he wrestled, he was called a prince with God.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And his name was changed to Israel, prince of God.
Yeah. Gee, we just come full circle. Let me go back to something, you know, that I've asked you before, because, you know, I know the answer. But boy, oh boy, teaching the Bible in public high schools as an elective today in the time when kids are eating Tide Pods and kids are snorting condoms. That was a story today, I swear. Snorting condoms is a new thing with some teenagers, and yet they're lecturing us about the Second Amendment. Obviously, some are and some aren't, but there's a lot of confusion today. So in today's world, isn't it a pretty tough sell?
Not really.
Isn't it a tough sell to sell the Bible, you know, as an elective in high school?
You know, we were able to get this reestablished in one school district in the state of Colorado where I live. It had been gone for 40 years. One school district said, yes, we're going to take that on. They accepted it. Teacher said, yeah, we're going to teach it. And they signed up and ended up with a waiting list to get into the class.
How great is that?
It was fascinating to watch that dynamic. Did you know, Karen, that right now this is one of the hottest classes in the Los Angeles County School District as a high school elective?
And nobody could need it more. We all need it to learn it. But in Los Angeles County, that is a
standard. In Los Angeles County, California. Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, vacuums always seek a substance, always seeks a vacuum or whatever.
Well, I think that many times.
And there is a vacuum.
I mean, where are you going to go after Tide Pods and condoms? Tell me.
That's what I was trying to say, especially in Los Angeles. I mean, where there's active intent to subvert the law. Like once you have a mayor giving information on how illegals can avoid capture, then where do you really go from there but back to the Bible, which is why I decided to do this show.
Well,
so where exactly? Tell us more about California and how that's going.
Well, it's going fantastic in that area. There are states that have now adopted this statewide, Kentucky being the latest one, I believe.
Hmm. Wow.
And so it is a fascinating exercise because of the fact that we do have a common fabric and a common heritage that binds us together. And nobody is saying that everybody is going to have to convert to Judaism or Christianity by force. That's not what's being done. It's an elective class. But there is a fabric that binds us together, and learning it only strengthens us.
Well, and we only have, I'm going to take a few extra minutes, Doug, and we're going to go up to hopefully the top of the hour, because I have a soundbite that I haven't even used, and it's one that you recommended. I want to get to that. I found it. I don't have the whole thing unless we want to play the whole thing. I kind of took the end of it. So why don't we go ahead and do that? Because this is something that Pastor Stephen Grant recommended that I look for, and I found it, and it's wonderful. I think I need to set it up, and that is that since the Ten Commandments were just played on network television over the weekend, because we just came off the Holy Week in Passover, we're still in Passover as we speak. It is a little speech made by the creator of the Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston, the film. And Cecil B. DeMille actually came out and gave a 2-minute speech. I cut it down to the last part, and it is eloquent as to why the film and the book, which is even better if you like the film, read the book, why the book is so important to Western civilization. Okay, Doug, go for it.
Ladies and gentlemen, young and old, this may seem an unusual procedure, speaking to you before the picture begins. But we have an unusual subject, the story of the birth of freedom, the story of Moses. As many of you know, the Holy Bible omits some 30 years of Moses' life. From the time he was a 3-month-old baby and was found in the bulrushes by Bithiah, the daughter of Pharaoh, and adopted into the court of Egypt, until he learned that he was Hebrew and killed the Egyptian. To fill in those missing years, we turn to ancient historians such as Philo and Josephus. Philo wrote at the time that Jesus of Nazareth walked the earth, and Josephus wrote some 50 years later and watched the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans. These historians had access to documents long since destroyed, or perhaps lost, like the Dead Sea Scrolls. The theme of this picture is whether men are to be ruled by God's law, or whether they are to be ruled by the whims of a dictator like Ramesses. Are men the property of the state, or are they free souls under God? This same battle continues throughout the world today. Our intention was not to create a story, but to be worthy of the divinely inspired story created 3,000 years ago, the 5 books of Moses. The story takes 3 hours and 39 minutes to unfold. There will be an intermission. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Doug, for playing that whole thing. I took the last minute, but he played the whole thing. That was smart and very quick. Comments, Pastor Stephen Grant?
You will notice that that is not played when it is aired on television these days.
That's right.
And that is such a powerful, powerful opening to the Ten Commandments. So here's my question. Why, other than to generate income through a commercial, would that be omitted? What is it that we are missing today?
And that was going
to be what needs to be restored.
A question that you'll have to give me a short answer to, and I know you have a long answer to, which is why are people so incredibly resistant to having something like the Bible Project as an elective? Why would there be the ACLU and other groups that would try vociferously to make sure that that doesn't happen, for the same reason that and what is that reason why they would make sure and take Cecil B. DeMille's speech off the beginning of the airing of the Ten Commandments?
Apparently there are people that are educating our children and educating our grandchildren that have an agenda, and it is to remove the validity of history and literature that have long been the foundation of education, to destroy and take it away and indoctrinate them with what they want. It's something of their own choosing. I believe that that's dangerous, and I believe we need to go back to what works.
So all the more reason that you have your project, and Dennis Prager is writing, embarking. He calls this the greatest mission, life's mission of his life, the greatest project of his life, is to write commentaries on the Torah. And obviously, there is a need and a hunger, whether you agree or disagree. And again, we have emphasized during this hour how the point is to wrestle with it. The point is to question
it
and find your own way through it. And it could not be made clearer, the connection between the great American, Pastor Stephen Grant, you wrote a book about it, about freedom.
Yes.
And that the Torah and, of course, Exodus is the very symbol of freedom. And we're losing it if we don't stand up to protect it and find the roots of it. How can people advise us as to where we ought to go if they don't know where we've been?
Right.
Right.
And so once again, if we begin with the Bible, we are miles ahead. And if people do not want scriptures once again to be the fabric of our moral foundation, if they do not want the Ten Commandments, if they do not want the Law and the Prophets, then we have a responsibility to stand up for that. We have a responsibility to speak up and speak out for that which has been lost.
Beautifully put. Pastor Stephen Grant, if listeners, you know that this show, well, we're doing it live right now. And of course, right now is wherever you are.
that's right.
Yeah, I know. If you're listening to it right now, it's present in your life, right? But once we record this show, which will be over momentarily, there are many, many, many places this show goes. And, as you know, on the internet, it has a life of its own. So you never know.
Absolutely.
How long and how and where this show will find its way. So where can people contact you? Where can people get involved in the Bible Project? If people are jazzed, and I am, about what you're doing, where can they go to contact you?
There are two areas. Number one is the church website where I pastor, and that will be godsdestiny.com, godsdestiny.com. And the other one about the Bible Project specifically is a website called reclaimamericashistory.com. Long website name, but it's very self-explanatory. reclaimamericashistory.com. And people can join us in there and join the movement to reclaim America.
That is wonderful. Thank you so much, Pastor Stephen Grant, for joining us. We are out of time. If you'd like to join me or comment on this program, you can go to my website, www.karencataline.com, Facebook/the same name, Twitter @the same name. Thanks to Doug, my producer, to BBS Radio, to HW, the multi-talented guy with the IQ greater than that of a small soap dish. And tune in next week when there will be a whole lot more to spout off about here on Spouting Off.